OA1.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Dan Friedel, and John Russell. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, China has attempted to balance its position on the conflict. President Xi Jinping's government has tried to distance itself from the Russian offensive, but it has also avoided direct criticism of Russia. In addition, China has offered to act as a negotiator in the conflict, but it has denounced trade and financial restrictions put on Russia by Western nations. Public support in China for the government's position has appeared in comments published on social media, the Associated Press reported. The ruling Communist Party's control of all Chinese media and heavy internet censorship make it hard to know the public's opinion. But the things the government permits media to report and the online material it chooses not to censor suggest what it might want the public to think. Expressions of sympathy for Ukraine appear in Chinese websites and on social media, along with support for Russia. But direct criticism of Russia or its activities in Ukraine is not easily found. One message published by a user of China's Weibo social media service expressed an opinion about the victims of war. When a war begins, is it not the children of ordinary people who serve as cannon fodder? The message said. The statement was published under the name Da Ke Mingyi. Those who died were the children of ordinary people, the user added. Recently, a letter signed by 5 university professors criticized Russia for attacking a weaker neighbor, the AP reported. We stand against unjust wars, said the letter, which appeared briefly on social media before it was removed. The group included professors at Beijing's Tsinghua University, where many ruling party leaders studied. Critics published comments on social media denouncing the professors for failing to represent the ruling party's official position of neutrality. The ruling party has spent many years using its school system and the state-controlled media to present a sense of national grievance. In other words, to support the feeling that one nation is mistreating another. The government efforts center on accusations that the United States has tried to block China's rise as a world leader. Chinese state media repeat the ruling party's position that the U.S. and its European allies are responsible for the war in Ukraine. China has argued that the West did not react favorably to Russia's demand that Ukraine be barred from joining the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. China has also long accused the U.S. and its allies of interfering in its national affairs. This includes issues such as China's claim over Taiwan and territorial disputes in the South China Sea. U.S. officials have also criticized Chinese government policies in the far western area of Xinjiang. That is where China is accused of detaining over 1 million ethnic Uyghurs. I'm Brian Lin.
The second season of the Basketball Africa League, BAL, started last weekend in Dakar, Senegal. 12 teams will compete this season for the BAL title. Last year, Egypt's Zamalek won the championship. The league was supposed to start in 2020, but was delayed a year by the COVID-19 pandemic. Last year, the season took place over 2 weeks in Kigali, Rwanda. This year, the schedule runs over 3 months and 38 games. They will be played in Dakar, Kigali, and Cairo, Egypt. The BAL is supported by America's National Basketball Association, NBA, and FIBA, basketball's international governing body. It is the first time the NBA has put money into a league outside of North America. Victor Williams is NBA Africa's president. At an event in Lagos, Nigeria in February, he said the league is evidence of the NBA's interest in growing the game across the continent. Sam Amadou is the president of FIBA Africa Zone 3, which includes Nigeria, Africa's most populous nation. He said, "The expanded number of games will permit more people to see games in person. It will help to popularize the game and attract more sponsorship," he said. A sponsor is a well-known company that supports a sports organization with money. Beyond sponsorships from Nike and Pepsi, the league also has the support of former United States President Barack Obama, who is working to help promote NBA Africa. The league announced in 2021 that Obama received part ownership of NBA Africa in return for his work. Obama said any money he receives will go to his foundation's programs in Africa. Dikembe Mutombo is a former NBA player from the Democratic Republic of Congo. He invested money to help start the league. Soccer is the most popular sport in Africa, but with a number of NBA players who are either from Africa or have an African parent, the sport of basketball is growing fast. There are about 50 NBA players with African roots. The most famous are Giannis Antetokounmpo of the Milwaukee Bucks, Joel Embiid of the Philadelphia 76ers, and Pascal Siakam of the Toronto Raptors. The league is hoping to help little-known players improve their game and get attention. Last season, 15 scouts watched the league. This year, each BAL team will have a young player from the NBA Academy Africa, a training center in Sali, Senegal, for teenage players. The program will provide another pathway for good African players to reach their potential as players and people, said Amadou Gallo Fall. He is the BAL president. One team leader, however, believes athletes should not only play to try to make the NBA, but to make the BAL a great league. I believe the BAL will grow as big as the NBA and bigger, said Relton Boysen, coach of the Cape Town Tigers, a new team in the BAL. I'm Dan Friedel.
Imagine that you want to talk about moral issues. Your opinion about what is correct behavior and what is incorrect behavior. You might want to talk about your actions or the actions of another. What kinds of terms and structures should you use? In today's Everyday Grammar, we will explore a point of connection between grammar and moral issues. You will learn about adjectives, sentence patterns, and expressions of necessity. Discussions about morality often involve adjectives, such as right or wrong. For example, an action is right or an action is wrong. The central structure for these kinds of statements is this: subject plus be plus subject complement. The subject complement is often an adjective. Common positive adjectives include right, correct, appropriate, or justified. Common negative adjectives include wrong, incorrect, terrible, or unjustified. A person might say, "My decision was appropriate. Their behavior was terrible. We were wrong," and so on. But there are many other ways a person can describe their opinion of an action. Let's listen to a few words from United States President Joe Biden's recent State of the Union speech. In the speech, he makes clear that he believes the actions of Russia are incorrect.
Putin's latest attack on Ukraine was premeditated and totally unprovoked.
Putin's attack on Ukraine is the subject of the sentence. Was, the past tense of be, is the main verb. Premeditated and unprovoked are terms that describe the attack. Premeditated is an adjective that means done or made according to a plan. Legal cases often use this term. A person might be convicted of premeditated murder, for example. Unprovoked means not caused by anything said or done. For example, a news story might describe an unprovoked attack. This means that one person or group was not doing or saying anything that would give reason for an attack. Another key area of grammar that connects with discussions about moral issues is the idea of necessity. An action must or must not be done. English speakers use several structures to express necessity, but some of the important ones are need to and have got to or have got to do. For example, imagine you hear a story about a disagreement between two of your family members. You might say, "You need to apologize to him," or "He needs to apologize to you." In both examples, you are saying that the right action to take is for one person to apologize to the other. You might also use "have got to" express a similar idea, as in, "You have got to apologize to him." Let's listen to UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson use the structure "have got to do" to talk about what he believes is a correct course of action.
We've got to do everything we can to change the heavy odds that Ukraine faces.
You might use "have got to do" to describe any number of moral issues. Imagine you have a friend who needs your help. You believe it is right to help him or her. You could say, "I have got to do something to help my friend." This report explored a few ways that English speakers talk about moral issues. There are certainly many other ways, politicians, religious experts, and normal people have debated moral questions for a long time. This report ends with a kind of homework project. Choose some kind of a moral question that interests you. Then find examples, films, news broadcasts, podcasts, and so on, that explore that moral question. Pay careful attention to the terms and structures that the speakers use. Then try to use what you have learned to describe your own opinion on the issue. I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. In December 1941, the United States was at war. It declared war against Japan after Japanese pilots attacked the American naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. A few days later, Germany and Italy declared war against the United States. President Franklin Roosevelt quickly decided that America could not fight major campaigns in the Pacific and in Europe at the same time. He and his advisors decided to fight first against the Germans and Italians. Then, when victory in Europe seemed sure, the United States could turn to fight the Japanese in Asia. This left the Japanese free to extend their power throughout Asia and the Western Pacific. Soon after the attack at Hawaii, Japanese forces invaded Hong Kong, Malaya, and the Philippines. American forces in the Philippines suffered heavy losses, and Manila fell to Japanese troops. In February 1942, Japan's forces won a great victory against the British in Singapore. Japanese forces marched into Burma. They attacked Ceylon, now Sri Lanka, and captured the Andaman Islands in the Bay of Bengal. The Japanese military forces seemed too strong to stop. President Roosevelt sent some forces to the Pacific, and he began to rebuild the American naval forces destroyed at Pearl Harbor. But he sent most of America's military strength to Europe. The United States rushed troops and war equipment to help Britain survive against Adolf Hitler's Germany. American military leaders wanted to fight Germany quickly by launching an attack across the English Channel. But British Prime Minister Winston Churchill opposed this. He and others feared such an invasion might fail. So British and American forces attacked Italian and German occupation troops in North Africa. They defeated them and then crossed the Mediterranean Sea to attack enemy forces in Sicily. Within weeks, they pushed the Germans out of Sicily to the Italian mainland. The Allied invasion of Italy followed. Hitler could not strengthen his forces in North Africa and Italy because Germany also was fighting hard in the Soviet Union. Hitler's decision early in the war to attack the Soviet Union was a serious mistake. It divided his men and materials. His plan was to defeat Soviet forces quickly with one strong attack. But he failed, and his failure cost him valuable troops and supplies that might have helped him win the battles for North Africa and Italy. Germany's attack on the Soviet Union began with great success. In the middle of 1941, a German force of more than 3 million men invaded the Soviet Union. It captured the Ukraine, took control of Kiev, and marched deep into Russia. The situation changed the following year. Soviet forces under Marshal Georgi Zhukov won a fierce battle for the city of Stalingrad, now Volgograd. A great many German soldiers died from cold and hunger during the bitter winter months that followed. Zhukov's forces attacked the German troops and pushed back the invaders. Other Soviet troops forced the Germans away from the city of Leningrad, now St. Petersburg. By the middle of 1944, German forces throughout the Soviet Union were retreating, and Soviet forces were preparing to push them over the border and invade Germany themselves. The fighting came at a terrible cost. Huge numbers of soldiers and civilians were killed. The fighting in World War II was not limited to land. Battles were also being fought on the sea. The main goal of the German Navy during the war was to prevent the United States from sending ships to Britain with war materials, food, and troops. At first, the Germans were very successful. There was hunger in Britain in 1941 because so few ships could cross the North Atlantic with food. German submarines were the greatest danger to ships crossing the Atlantic. These U-boats, as the Germans called them, could hide below the surface and attack without warning. The threat from German submarines did not ease until new technology was developed in 1943. Allied scientists improved sonar and radar systems that helped find submarines on the surface and underwater. More of the enemy submarines were found and destroyed. The Allies slowly gained control of the Atlantic. Allied and German warships fought a number of traditional naval battles, but airplanes came to play an increasingly important part in the fighting at sea. British ships, with the help of planes launched from an aircraft carrier, destroyed a powerful German battleship, the Bismarck, on May 27, 1941. The most famous air battle of the war in Europe took place during the summer and autumn of the previous year. It was known as the Battle of Britain. It got its name from a speech to Parliament by Prime Minister Churchill following the evacuation of British and French forces from Dunkirk.
This is the BBC Home Service. Here is the news. In the House of Commons this afternoon, the Prime Minister, Mr. Churchill, said, "What General Vagar called the Battle of France is over. The Battle of Britain is about to begin."
It was the most extensive aerial bombing yet in the war. It was also the first battle to be fought entirely in the air. German Stuka dive bombers attacked shipping centers, areas of political importance, airfields, and airplane factories. Luftwaffe pilots in their Messerschmitts battled the Hurricanes and Spitfires of the Royal Air Force. While the flying skills of the German and British pilots were well matched, it was ultimately the greater maneuverability of the British Spitfire that won the long months of battle over the English Channel. The British victory in the air helped prevent Operation Sea Lion, a planned German invasion of Britain. In May of 1942, Britain's Royal Air Force carried out an attack on Germany with 1,000 bombers. It was just the first of many bombing runs over Germany and German-occupied areas by the air forces of Britain and the United States. The planes bombed German military and industrial centers. They also bombed civilian targets in an effort to demonstrate to the German people the price of Germany's aggression. The German cities of Cologne, Dresden, and Hamburg suffered widespread destruction. The Allied bombing attacks continued until the war's end in 1945. Hitler's victories in the early months of the war had struck fear into the hearts of people throughout the world. Hitler and his Axis allies had won battle after battle. They had captured most of Western Europe and invaded the Soviet Union. They had seized North Africa, and their submarines controlled the Atlantic. Germany continued to seem strong during the first months after the United States entered the war in Europe. But the situation began to change. German strength and control were greatest in November of 1942. After then, the mighty German military machine began to slow down. Germany and its Axis partner, Italy, suffered serious losses in the first 6 months of 1943. German losses were extremely heavy in the Soviet Union. 160,000 German troops died at Stalingrad, and more than 110,000 surrendered. American and British forces captured 250,000 German and Italian troops in North Africa. Many more thousands were killed or captured in Sicily and the Italian mainland. German submarines were being destroyed in the North Atlantic, allowing more Allied troops and supplies to reach Britain. By the end of 1943, Hitler and his armies no longer seemed so strong. But German forces continued to occupy France, Belgium, and much of the rest of Western Europe. Now the time had come for the Allies to invade German-held Europe from Britain. Allied forces planned the greatest military invasion in history to break the German control of Europe and win the war.
People of Western Europe, a landing was made this morning on the coast of France by troops of the Allied Expeditionary Force. This landing is part of a concerted United Nations plan for the liberation of Europe. Although the initial assault may not have been made in your own country, the hour of your liberation is approaching.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.